Hello once again and welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Patrick Donges. Today we gather our panel of experts in areas including biology, physics, and geology to respond to your science-related questions and comments on what we like to call the Science Forum. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop. That's one word, WAMC VOXPOP, or check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. But first, let's meet our panel of experts. Dr. Ken Wells is a physicist with over three decades at General Electric. Is that correct, sir?
Yep.
All right. And Dr. George Shaw is professor emeritus of geology and geophysics at Union College. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Dr. Barbara Brabitz, we are awaiting on her, is a professor of biochemistry at State University of New York at Cobleskill. And she got stuck in a little bit of traffic, so we are awaiting her arrival. Guys, welcome to Vox Pop.
Thank you.
So we were chatting a moment ago about the landing of, now this is
Curiosity.
The Curiosity.
Yes.
I'm a little curious about what was going on.
That was very impressive. The machinations that NASA went through, because they this is so heavy, they couldn't land it the way they landed the last two rovers. And the last two rovers, of course, got our expectations way up for this sucker, because they were made to last, I think, 2 months, and they went for years and years and years, and one is still operating, sort of. So that's really cool. But this one is even more capable. Had the 7 minutes of terror, they called it, where it was land. It took 7 minutes to land, and they had no idea if it was going to crash or what, because it was such a complicated series of maneuvers. But it got down fine, and it started to take pictures, and this thing even has freaking laser beams on it.
Whoa.
To evaporate rocks. So we've put weapons into space already.
Uh-oh. I don't know if that's what are we looking for?
Well, we're looking at more of the geology, mm-hmm. geography, and hopefully to understand if there was a time on Mars when life could have formed, and possibly to look for existing or obvious signs of life. They've landed it in a location that they think has a lot of geology exposed. A lot of the history of Mars is exposed because of an impact of a meteor that left this crater that it's in.
Aside from there being some kind of creature showing up on camera waving at the rover, what would be a sign that there was life or could be life on Mars?
A sign that there was life could be microfossils, okay. of a number of sorts. But the signs that there is life, you would look for byproducts of life. And that might be methane or free oxygen, because it would be sort of hard to explain those if they were produced from a sample that you put in an incubator. It'd be pretty hard to explain those by any method other than some sort of living process.
Now, I think that's true if they were produced by a subsample that was incubated. But we already know there's oxygen in the atmosphere of Mars, not very much. And we also know or think there's a very high probability there's methane there, but neither of those in and of themselves are signposts for life.
Yes,
because there are plenty of abiotic processes that will produce both of them. But you're right, if you have a sample and you incubate under certain conditions and gases are produced that you wouldn't otherwise expect, except for life being present, that would be interesting.
A pretty good sign that there might have been or could be. Could there still be something up there?
It's certainly we know that there's conditions on Mars where there's water ice, and we have seen extremophiles on Earth where microscopic things can live in ice. But does that mean that, well, it's always possible that, right. there's some basic form of life up there.
All right. Dr. Barbara Babbitt's joining us.
Hey, Patrick.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Traffic's bad.
All right. No problem. Let's get to the calls here. Layla in Mount Tremter, New York. You're on Vox Pop.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question relates to the movement of air at dawn. I'm often up before dawn, and I notice a couple things when dawn starts. First of all, there seems to be a breeze that picks up if there's not already a breeze. And secondly, our house is built on a little bit of a slope, and it seems that the cool night air kind of rolls into the house on the side of the house that's facing the upslope, if you know what I mean. And I was just curious if there was something happening with the movement of air that would stimulate the cooler air to start moving, if you know what I mean. And I'm guessing it has something to do with the beginning of the rising of the sun. So hope that's clear.
Well, certainly when the sun is out, you get warming. And when you get warming of the earth, you get warming of the air immediately over the earth. And when the air is warm, it's less dense, so it rises, okay? So the air will rise above, around the areas where the most sunlight hits, and cool air will move in to replace it. So that's basically what causes most of the wind that you get is uneven heating of the air.
And it even heats more unevenly water versus land. For example, you won't get the same phenomenon over an ocean or a large body of water, but you will over land because land heats up much faster than water does. I mean, just go to Million Dollar Beach on a hot day in Lake George, and the sand itself is going to be 90, 95. But you put your toesies in, and if it's May, it's 55 degrees, same heat that's running down there, but the water is much more resistant to changes in temperature than the air. So you get uneven heating that way, too, and that's why you'll also find some really interesting weather at the edge of a continent where it hits water.
I remember living in Ireland, which is an island, and the weather would literally change 5-6 times in one day. It could be pouring, it could be sunny, it could be cloudy, it could be anything.
And the sunny is a question mark over Ireland anyway, right?
That's right. You couldn't dress for anyone and any one thing.
Hey, Layla, did we answer your question?
You did. Thank you very much.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Patrick, there's one other issue, too, with heating. If you think of dawn in particular, your sun is going to hit the upper part of the atmosphere before it hits the land because we're spherical and
sure,
that's the way it goes. So you've got heating above the ground before the ground actually sees sunlight. So that contributes to that whole kind of stratification and mixing phenomenon that she was seeing.
Great. All right. Well, let's keep going here. We have Carrie in Plainfield, Massachusetts. Carrie, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for getting hold of me here. My question touches both on physics and biology. And the question is, if a cat or a squirrel is up in a tree, let's say 30 feet, and they fall out of the tree, there's a great chance that when they hit the ground, they're just going to take off. Might be a little scared, but they're going to run away. If a human being were to fall out 30 feet out of a tree, they're going to probably break some bones and somebody's going to be calling 911. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
Mostly the mass. And if you think about it, if you drop an elephant 10 feet, even just 10 feet, where we'd be okay, that elephant's probably going to break some bones.
Ow.
Okay?
Just don't be under the elephant when it falls.
But if you drop a mouse from 60 feet, it's probably going to be fine if it doesn't hit something hard.
And so if the elephant sees the mouse,
I would think like 60 feet for a mouse would be really high compared to a person who's 6 foot tall.
Right, but it doesn't scale with the distance of your fall doesn't scale with your size because of something called the three-halves ratio. The body goes up in mass or weight by the cube of the size, and the bone structure goes up as the square. The length of the bones goes up as the first power. But you get this uneven effect where you have the lighter something is.
It's the body mass you're talking about.
Yeah, it's the body mass. Plus, there's another effect. Humans have to fall a fair distance. They have to fall, what does it take to reach 60 miles an hour? About 50 feet, 100 feet?
I don't know, but at a certain point, it doesn't matter if you fall from the 20th story or the 30th story.
Right, because you reach terminal velocity. Mm. Well, terminal velocity is a lot faster for a human if a human with all their limbs spread out, I think it's somewhere around 50 to 80 miles an hour, whereas a cat falling from a great distance, if it puts its legs out to the side, it's actually falling fairly slowly, probably mm-hmm. around 20, 25 miles an hour. A squirrel, even less.
Terminal velocity being the speed at which
where you don't accelerate anymore because right. the air resistance is equal to the pull of the gravity.
It's slowing you down, the air resistance.
All right, well, you answered my question.
Well, there's a biology piece too, Carrie, and that is that cats in their spinal column have more flexibility than we do. They can actually, don't do this at home. Professionals, when they drop a cat with their back facing the earth, the cat rotates first its hindquarters 180 degrees so that its back legs are pointed towards the earth, and then rotates its front. We don't have the ability to get that limber.
That's interesting.
So they have special cartilage in their back for that because, even though we're ancestral, our ancestors are tree people, their ancestral ties to trees are much closer than ours. So they have more of that tree-like ability.
I would assume a squirrel probably, too, because I live in the woods and I see squirrels do that all the time.
Well, that isn't an ancestral. That's just the squirrel. And sometimes when the baby squirrels are out there, you can see them. They try to do the jump, and they don't do the jump well because they're new at it, and they fall down. Every once in a while, one will break its neck or something, but ultimately they'll just kind of get laughed at by the other squirrels and run away.
And this is such a part of the squirrel profession, if you will, that jumping from tree to tree, a species of squirrel evolved specifically for jumping. This flying squirrel.
Well, the flying squirrel uses that.
Once in a while, they're not always a gold medalist, correct?
Yes.
Right. Usually the young ones.
And Carrie, I've heard that if you attach a piece of buttered toast to the back of a cat, if I'm correct, face up, that it'll just spin in air.
It never hits the ground.
Never hits the ground.
Peanut butter extra.
That's great.
Yes.
Hey, Carrie, thanks so much for your call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Now, I had a question, Barbara.
Yeah.
You said when a professional drops a cat.
Well,
droppers?
We're going to have to return to this. We're up against the break here, but when we come back,
we'll
professional cat droppers right here on Vox Pop.
Support for Vox Pop on WAMC comes from Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available. TheDamCafeAndDeli.com. The Cooperstown Summer Music Festival, presenting the Tierney Sutton Band August 12th, 7:30 p.m. at the Otisauga Resort Hotel. CooperstownMusicFest.org. PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York, presenting Takei Dance Company, performing Salaryman and other new works on Friday, August 10th and Saturday, August 11th at 8 p.m. PS21Chatham.org. And Berkshire Medical Center's Joint Replacement Program, private rooms, pre-surgical education, rehabilitation, program coordinator, and 6 orthopedic surgeons. 413-395-7680.
1-800-348-2551. We're back on Vox Pop with the Science Forum. And is anybody here a certified cat dropper?
No.
Not me.
Okay. Getting back to the calls. Jeff in Chester, New York, it looks like you have a geologic question.
Yes, I have a couple, and I'll warn you that they're both relating to flood evidence here in North America. My first question is on the subject of the Sand Dunes Monument by Alamosa, Colorado.
I know it.
And do you have an explanation for where all the sand comes from?
It's the result of weathering. The rocks weather, they break down, and quartz grains are very resistant to weathering, especially chemical weathering. So they remain behind, and then they can be blown by the wind. And that area is quite windy. That, of course, doesn't explain why the dunes are there. You can have a lot of blowing sand, and if there's nothing in the way, it just keeps going. But the prevailing wind direction brings these sand dunes right up next to the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. And mm-hmm. the particles pile up there. There are streams that come to the mountains are to the east. The streams just keep carrying the sand back down into the basin or the edge of the basin. And so the sand piles up and forms these big dunes. It's very spectacular.
But the dunes don't stand in one place, do they? They tend to move them. The main location for the whole monument is stationary, but the dunes themselves tend to move.
Well, no, the dunes more or less occupy the same area all the time. The sand gets blown up the windward face of the dune, down the leeward side. The sand eventually arrives at where the streams are located. The streams pick up the sand, carry it back out into the basin. So to a first approximation, the dunes are stagnant. That doesn't mean the sand doesn't keep moving up and that the actual sand dune topography might change slightly. But basically, the system is maintained in a dynamic equilibrium.
Because in Oregon, where they've got a tremendous number of dunes on the beach, you can see the dunes constantly moving. Over a year, they'll move 10, 20, 30 feet. They won't leave the area. That is, they'll just, the peak will move, and then a new one will form behind it. The peak will move, and a new one will form behind it. So
right, that can happen.
Very dynamic that way.
Right. Over a long period of time.
The place is very dear to my heart, and when I visited it, 30 or 35 years ago, the explanation of where the sand actually came from, I thought, was severely lacking. When I was there, most recent visit was just a few years ago. The ranger there spoke with me at great length and agreed that when I asked him specifically, where did all that sand come from, and he pointed me in a different direction. He said they are trying to change their description, and he said what was more interesting now, they've been drilling out in the valley there, halfway between the monument and the Alamosa. And they're drilling down into the valley and finding that the sediment is arranged as if, as if it was sediment, I guess, in the past. And I think they're in the process of changing their description of where all that sand came from. But can I ask you one other question, which I still think is related to this?
Go ahead, Jim.
About my Google search on the subject of fossilized dinosaur eggs?
Sure.
Because I looked for the locations in North America of all the fossilized dinosaur eggs, and I think with the exception of like one of them, I think they were all located in a line that runs kind of north-north-south through the Colorado Rocky Mountains, about, I don't know, maybe 100 miles in from the Denver Front Range. It's a line that goes through the Dinosaur National Monument and like a bunch of other places up in the mountains where I guess they find this kind of remains.
Well, in the Cretaceous and late Jurassic, this part of North America was the central part was actually an inland sea that stretched all the way from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to the Arctic, and there was land to the west and land to the east, and a lot of the dinosaur remains you find were deposited or preserved in sediments that were on the western side of this shallow inland sea. So it's not only a sedimentarily active environment, but you can imagine with having water right there and everything that goes with water in terms of nutrients and availability of food, there was probably a lot of life in, probably kind of like deltaic or river mouth environment. So lots of biologic activity, lots of sediment being deposited, shifted around, and ideal circumstances for producing fossil remains.
Does it take different conditions to preserve fossil eggs than it does to preserve fossil dinosaurs? Mm.
You need something, because the dinosaurs laid their eggs, or at least the terrestrial dinosaurs laid their eggs on land, and the land surface is a very active place where material is moved around. You get erosion and resedimentation, so you would need a situation where probably some kind of an event would bury these eggs, bury the nests, and then they wouldn't be exposed again until they had been sitting there and were fossilized over a long period of time. And this, again, is something that can happen in a coastal environment. You can have major flood events that just huge amounts of sediment are spilled out onto the floodplain, bury the nests, and then they become part of the sedimentary pile in the floodplain back from the river.
And in the early geologic record, before the vertebrates, we really had a lot of these kind of like avalanche events too, where there would be kind of like mudslides where you'd have funky geology right next to the water mass, and that would give us things like around here, like the Utica shales and so on and so forth. Is that right, George?
Well, the Utica shales, not so much landslides.
Well, they're
The Utica Shale, if you look in the vicinity of Utica, out near Herkimer, if you go past the Indian Castle rest area. You go up toward Herkimer, you go up this hill and then down the other side, you'll see these crinkled layers. And these are probably the result of submarine land slipping, not a huge landslide, but kind of a sliding on the weak rocks of the Utica Shale. And some of these upper limestone beds are crinkled in very short wavelength folds. This is probably almost entirely soft sediment phenomenon before the material had actually been lithified into solid rock.
So that was underwater, but kind of by the shore?
The Utica Shale is probably somewhat deeper water, not necessarily right at the shoreline. Not the conventional mega landslide sort of phenomenon, for that at least.
Okay.
Hey, Jeff, thanks so much for the call.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I don't know enough about geology as I would like to, but in the future, instead of another show that tells me what killed the dinosaurs, I wish they would have a show that describes what piled up all their carcasses up there in the mountains in Montana. Well, you know, instead of them coming out and saying they're social creatures. And if I could just comment about the falling animals question.
Go on.
Because the coolest thing I ever heard on that subject was a distinct ratio of the surface area to volume.
Yep.
It was the simple ratio of surface area to volume, whereas if you had a spider, for example, that's got a lot of surface area and a very small amount of item, you could drop them off the Empire State Building and it wouldn't really care.
But you got to be a professional if you're going to drop anything off the Empire State Building.
No, I'm not going to do it. Thank you so much.
Hey, dang, thanks, Jeff. Take care. All right. Let's, we're not going to go to Kathy we are. Here we go. Kathy and Troy, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, Patrick and panel. How's everybody today?
All right.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thank you for the show. I always learn something.
Us too.
I have kind of a perplexing question. See if anybody has any ideas for me. I kept my lawnmower and gasoline can in an unsecured shed. In other words, it was open on three sides, so it's readily accessible on the fourth. And I went out the other day, or actually it was a couple months ago by now, and something had chewed through the nozzle on the gas can so that if I had attempted to pour out of it, it would have just run out through the nozzle.
Yep.
The same creature went through the gasoline cap.
Yep.
So right through it, and it tried the gasoline tank.
This doesn't have anything to do with bath salts, does it? Kathy, not you. I'm saying what may have gone after the gasoline, right?
Yep, got the same problem.
It was dropped too many times.
Oh, good.
On its
I'm
head.
Glad. Any ideas?
It's a squirrels.
Is it really?
Squirrels or chipmunks? Yes. And the reason I say now I have seen squirrels leaving the area. I haven't actually seen them biting, but they are the tooth marks on the gas filler cap on my sawmill is chewed through.
Wow.
And on the all the gas cans that I have, they get chewed up. And I attribute this to recent legislation.
The ethanol.
No, not the ethanol. No.
They want to get drunk.
They want to get drunk. No.
Before they fall off a building.
What I think they're doing is we've had new regulations on emissions from gas cans and things. And so they've made the gas can so they don't let vapors out.
Right.
Okay. So these squirrels, they go up, they see a plastic container, and what do they say? Oh, sunflower seeds inside. I know that because I've lived around humans all my life. So I'm going to eat through till I find the sunflower seeds. And if there's no sunflower seeds, I'll go eat somewhere else. But with the old gas cans, you could smell what was inside. Well, they can't smell what's inside with the new ones. I think they're going in there hoping for something edible inside, and they'll chew until they get the stink of gasoline coming out, and then they don't come anymore, or at least mine don't. Once they've breached the airtight seal, they don't try anymore. So that's my hypothesis. Barbara apparently thinks.
Until you put a new gas cap on. I have two chewed up gas caps on my rototiller.
There's an epidemic here.
Oh, my gosh.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Well, we need to get more cats, apparently, for the neighborhood.
That may be the answer.
Yeah.
It's a moot point now because I have a new gas cap and a new gas tank, and everything is squirreled, no pun intended, away in my garage.
You think they can't get in there? Once the word gets out, you're doomed.
All right, my rototiller was in the garage both times.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
Jeez. Well, Kathy, thanks.
My fingers crossed.
Dev, keep your fingers crossed. Keep your keep your items locked up there, definitely. Thanks for the call.
Bitter apple, actually.
Okay.
Bitter apple. Right. If you spray bitter apple on the plastic, it'll keep them away until it gets wet.
Where do I get that?
You can get it at a pet supply store because it's meant for dogs and cats, and it's just a really bad taste to any mammal. Won't work for birds.
Doesn't harm the animal at all.
Not at all.
Nasty taste.
Nasty taste.
Okay. Merle in Argyle, you have a 100-pound beam on your shoulder, I've heard, so...
Yeah, and I'm curious because the weight issue, and if I am carrying a beam on my shoulder, 100 pounds, do I have 100 pounds on the shoulder, or is it distributed along the beam? In other words, like gravity is pulling down on the beam all over, so... Theoretically, I have less weight on my shoulder. Because the question is whether or not when I put something on a scale and it's balanced in the center, am I getting a true weight from
the
scale?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
So I do have, if I have a 100-pound beam that's 20 feet long and I put it on my shoulder, I have all 100 pounds
All 100 pounds is on your shoulder. If it's a 500-foot-long carbon fiber rod and the ends don't sag and touch the ground and you put it on your shoulders, still got the same 100 pounds.
Even though it doesn't feel like it.
It feels like it.
Well,
when you balance something that's heavy, it might take you two hands to pick it up off the ground, but you could... balance it on your shoulder when you get it towards the middle, and it sort of seems like the weight is being, you're losing some of the weight.
Like it gets lighter once you've got it up on your shoulder.
Once it's balanced, it feels lighter because your sense of weight is the effort taken to hold it up. If you put it in, if you lift it from the ground, you're using all these muscles in your body to lift it up. Once you put it on your shoulders, if you've got it there correctly, most of the weight is sitting on your spinal cord, your skeletal structure, and not so much of it is supported by muscles.
I think
it's less effort.
I think Merle's point is that if he had it off center on his shoulder, it would still be 100 pounds, but it feels like a lot more because you're fighting this center of gravity, the weight balance of it all. So, like, if instead of being in the middle of the beam on your shoulder, if you had it almost to one end, even though it's still 100 pounds, there's that torque. It's trying to pull itself down on the other end.
There's
but
more
it's
beam
still
on
100.
One end.
But the weight on a scale, it wouldn't matter where it was.
Wouldn't matter where it is.
You can do that experiment. Take your beam.
Yeah.
Take about a, let's say, a 4-foot beam just to keep it within reason.
Right.
And put it on its side, balanced on the middle of your scale, and look at the weight. Then turn the beam on end and put the end on the middle of the scale, making sure that you balance it. And I think you'll find that the weight is exactly the same.
Yep.
And even if you used it as a fulcrum type.
Well,
where
if
just
it's
sort
touching,
of,
then all bets are
you
off.
You only have a quarter inch holding the beam on the scale. It would still weigh
if it's balanced.
If it's balanced,
you know, when you say fulcrum, it means like some other part of the beam is touching something else. As long as the beam is totally in the air and only being supported by the scale, not by if you hold one end of the beam up, say you have a 100-pound beam. If you put one end on the scale and you the other end you hold off to the side, it's only going to weigh about 50 pounds, depending on how even the beam is, because you're holding 50 pounds at one end and 50 pounds at the other.
Right.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Hey, Merle, thanks so much for the call.
Well, thank you.
Yep. Take care.
Bye.
All right. 1-800-348-2551. We are here on Vox Pop with the Science Forum. Let's go to Pamela in Troy. Pamela, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I went out just after sunset last night to let the house air out and get a little fresh air outside. And I've noticed this before, but it just really struck me last night. There was a lot of noise from, I'm thinking, insects, but I don't know if there might have been some little frog or toad-like things. And I was wondering, what am I likely to be hearing outside at this time of year?
I always thought they were crickets.
Well, I could tell they were crickets, but there seemed to be two or three different distinct sounds.
Yeah, there's a new one that's popped up, I'd say, in the last 2 weeks. Is that about your recollection? It's my husband called them peepers last night, and I said they're not peepers because they're not a frog. Peeper isn't doing it this time of year. But it had that same kind of cadence of the beep, beep. You know, I can't do a peeper on the radio, but kind of a high-pitched, two-tone, constant whir. And, you know, I meant to look it up last night, but I got distracted by the International Space Station going overhead, and then there were meteors, and then, I don't know, then there was Olympics, and I just never got to it. But I was thinking it's got to be, it's certainly an insect. It wasn't a frog. We're not in the right season for that kind of mating. And it's not a cicada, and it wasn't a June bug, what we would call a June bug. So it was something else. But there are certain bugs that erupt later in the season and that require a drought to really emerge. So
okay.
I'm wondering what one or ones it was. It's not something I think we see typically.
Now, is the volume that she hears typically temperature-related? Because it was very warm last night.
It was. I would think it also would be an emergence, because if this is one of these periodic emergence, you know, where they come out and now they're adults and ready to do the deed, they got to call each other all together in order to do the deed so that they can implant their eggs back in the ground for whenever the conditions are right for them to hatch again. So it could have been a heat thing, but my guess is that it's like, it's the call to arms. Everybody get over here. There's going to be a love fest over on Pam's property in Troy. And that's the call to pull them all out of the ground and get them into a generalized location for breeding.
Mm. I think if you kept records and kept track, you'd probably find that late July or the last half of July and through much of August, that there was a lot more noise. That's my observation,
yeah.
Anyway, that this time of year is one of the noisiest for being outside.
And I have to say, too, less birds. The birds are busy, and the boy birds, I'm a birder, not a bug person, but the boy birds have started to leave. And some of the women and children are left behind to fend for themselves until September or October. But since the males are the ones that sing and they don't have a territory to defend and they're bugging out, so to speak, it's getting a lot quieter. So you'll even notice in the early dawn hours, you're not getting as much bird activity.
And you said the frogs are not making noise now. Why is that?
They tend to breed on the second or third warm day, after ice out, so it tends to be, depending on when we are in the season,
just once a year,
early May, and they tend to get it over with because,
okay, well,
you know, they need to like peepers, for example. Mm. Certainly ice out sometimes is before the peepers are the peepers will actually make noise while the ice is still floating in the bog.
Mm-hmm.
But your typical green frog or leopard frog, the amphibians too, they'll make the other amphibians, there are nights where you can go online and see when the amphibians are going to run to the water to go mate.
Oh.
And they have specialized teams in certain locations where we have endangered amphibians, like the hellbender, which is like a salamander. And they will actually stop traffic so that the hellbenders can go to the ponds. They know when it's going to be based on the weather, the temperature, and the time of year.
Well,
so it's
pretty
specific.
I still have bullfrogs calling at this time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But
they just do it year-round?
They just, yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Pam, thanks so much. We're up against
I was just going to say, I could tell there were at least three different types of calls. There was the crickets, there was something a little harsher and raspier, and then there was something that reminded me a little bit of peepers, but I didn't think that's what it was.
There's something new maybe out there.
Well, there'll be katydids out there by this time.
Yeah. You know, Pam, I'll do my homework and talk to my insect people, and then the next time I'm on the show, which will probably be in September or October.
That sounds right.
It'll be a new set of bugs by then, but at least I'll have an answer.
Okay, that'd be great. I'll be listening.
Okay.
Excellent. Thanks, Pam. 1-800-348-2551, and we'll be back right after this. So
Support for Vox Pop comes from Mother Earth's Storehouse, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Saugerties. Natural food and vitamin centers serving the Hudson Valley with organic and natural foods since 1978. MotherEarthStorehouse.com. The Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute, Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting the Carpe Diem String Quartet on Tuesday, August 14th. ClarkArt.edu for tickets. Kent School, working to help students develop their passions and a lifelong love of the arts. Kent-school.edu. And the Berkshire Fringe, presenting Riot, an epic tale of violence, greed, and cheap sofas, now through August 13th at Simon's Rock. BerkshireFringe.org.
one 800 348 2551. We are back on Vox Pop with the Science Forum, and I have a biological question. The other day on the show, we were talking about the Olympics and a little bit about doping and how this gentleman, the judo fighter from Glenville, was asked to leave the Olympics because he tested positive for marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of the callers who called in said, because the International Olympic Committee, they have recognized they don't consider marijuana a performance-enhancing substance, but yet because of its illegal status in many of the countries, they have put it on the banned list. But a couple of callers who called in said, well, you know, it maybe it puts them in the zone, you know, that maybe if you're an athlete, an elite athlete, and one of these first cases in 98 was a snowboarder, and we had a skier call in and say, you know, I know guys who ski and ice ski and who use marijuana, and it puts them in the zone, and it makes them feel like, you know, they're invincible and they can just power through, and that might be the cause. From a biochemical standpoint, could marijuana in any way enhance an athlete's performance?
Well, you know that at that level, at the Olympic level, there's really two levels of performance. There's the physical performance. You see that in the physical specimens
Sure.
that are in the Olympics. And then there's the mental performance. You've seen people crack under pressure. I won't call anybody out because I'm not at the Olympics on a balance beam or on the floor exercise. But things happen and you can crack. And that's probably much more mental, like don't screw up now in your head and then you go and screw
on
up.
On the world stage, sure.
Right. It's a lot of pressure. And many sports performers, think of baseball players who are in a run of bad luck. They end up going to sports psychologists, not because they need help with their swing, but they need to get help with dealing with the fact that they're in a slump and not think about it every time they're up at the plate. So the brain issue is a big issue. THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, is a hallucinogen. So it's not a narcotic in that sense. It doesn't increase your metabolism, but it alters your brain chemistry the way any hallucinogen would. So any alteration in brain chemistry could give people an altered sense of reality. It could allow them to relax. Some people don't relax that way. Other people could. But the fact that it's hallucinogenic is why I agree with it being banned from
competition.
Well,
that's very interesting. So it could that whole being in the zone idea is a thing.
Like bath salts. Yeah.
Sure.
Wrong zone.
Yeah.
All right. We have we're back up here. We got a full boat, and Sally in Fort Plain, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi there. My question is Adirondack type. With fall coming, I wondered what conditions make the fog lay low over a lake for quite a while?
Warm lake, cold air.
Not only that, but the lake is water, and fog is just condensed water. So if you got a huge water supply, if you got that water going into the atmosphere when it's a little warmer, the air is warm, and then the atmosphere above it cools off the vapors that are coming off the lake, boom, you get a fog.
Ah, so if the temperature stays relatively above the vapor steady, it could sit on the water for quite a while?
Or if it even goes colder.
Right. Yeah, as long as the air is colder than the water, your conditions are right. And the colder the air gets, relative to the water temperature, the more likely you are to have fog or heavy fog even.
And one of the pieces that's crucial too is no wind, because the wind will mix the air temperature from bottom to top. And as soon as you get mixing, you'll usually get the fog to dissipate. So oftentimes you'll hear, well, the sun is burning off the fog. It's really not the sun. It's really the heating that goes with the sun that's doing it.
Okay, I will let you get on to all your other callers.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Sally.
Great question.
Take care. We have somebody checking in. We have Bill calling in and says that the last night what he heard was the American toad, he believes.
Really?
Does that make sense?
I don't know.
All right.
I swore it didn't sound like a frog.
No
toad. It didn't sound like a reptile.
More like
an insect. Or amphibian to me. But I will take Bill's suggestion along with the rest of my homework.
All right, and now we've got somebody else calling in with the with a comment on the night sounds. Barbara in Monticello, hello, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, I don't know about up by Troy, but down here in this part of the country, we're listening to the katydids every night, and they can be deafening at times.
Mentioned earlier,
The old timers used to say it was, when you heard the katydids, it was 6 weeks till frost.
Gosh, I hope they're wrong.
Jeez.
Maybe global warming will push that somewhat.
Hey. Maybe, but that's what I'm wondering, if maybe that's what she's hearing.
Well, I heard the katydids too, but I they have kind of a lower, yes, they're deafening, but they have a lower tone. This was a higher toned type of
insect. We don't have that down
frog.
Here. Or at least I haven't heard
maybe
it.
Maybe tomorrow.
Thank you.
Maybe you'll hear it tomorrow night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Barbara. All right, let's go to Rod in... Rod, where are you?
Agawam.
Agawam, there we go.
Right.
You're on Vox Pop.
Yes, sir. I was going to comment on the gentleman who called in earlier about the carrying the I-beam on his shoulder. And I think maybe he was thinking about, not in terms of the weight of the I-beam, which, well, you're right, would never change, but the amount of pressure being applied would be a function of the square inches and the amount of weight that you're applying it over or displacing it over.
Mm-hmm.
As you would have, like, a great example was, I remember in physics class many, many years ago, a woman's high-heeled shoe, a woman, say, weighing 120 pounds, but the point of her high-heeled shoe could apply as much as 12 to 1,500 PSI at that point, because of the displacement of the amount of weight over the square inches that you're displacing it. So I believe that the issue he might have been talking about was the amount of pressure being applied on his shoulder.
Just the way
something he would be aware of.
Yeah, just the way the if you have a backpack with narrow straps, you get tired a lot sooner than if you have a backpack with big, broad, padded straps.
Your example's better than mine. I was thinking a bra, but that's okay.
I wasn't. So, but if you're carrying a beam any distance, the shoulders might be the place where you get the most total square inches of body contact for supporting it. So that might make it seem the lightest. That's a good point. Thank you, Rod.
Okay. You're welcome, sir.
Hey, Rod, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Rich in Hudson. Rich, you're on Vox Pop.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You got my thoughts going. You got on the squirrel subject.
Dropping them or chewing on gasoline caps?
Well, we live in a neighborhood that's loaded with them, and they drive National Grid crazy. They get up on top of the pole and stretch their body from one part to another.
Mm-hmm.
They only do that
once, though.
The whole
neighborhood out. And yet a tree branch can fall down on the wires and sit there and sizzle for an hour and even catch on fire, and we don't lose our power.
Uh-huh.
Squirrels are better conductors than trees.
Excuse me?
Squirrels are better electric conductors than wood.
It's all that darn blood.
Squirrels are filled with salt water, and salt water conducts electricity a lot better than damp cellulose, which is what a tree is made of.
Uh-huh.
So they'll pull a lot more current.
And also they have muscles. When those muscles have an electric current applied to them, they tend to contract. So your squirrel's not going to stay in the same position when he's electrocuted. He's going to tense up, and when he tenses up, he's going to fall off.
And like I say, National Grid, they've come down here and put these peculiar-looking cones over a lot of the infrastructure. So
I don't know if that's going to keep them out.
If a squirrel goes on top of something, it's not going to short something out. I could never understand. Now you've answered my question.
Well, if you just throw empty gas caps on the ground, then they'll be so busy.
they'll just go after the caps. So, there you go.
Maybe we ought to put some trails of sunflower seeds down through the neighborhood.
There you go. All right. Well, hey, Rich, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yep, take care. All right, let's go to Pete in Orange, Massachusetts. Pete, how's it going?
Pretty good. I joined late. I just got out of work at 2:30. I have a question that's been bugging me for a while.
All right.
I hope you can answer it. What is the difference between methane gas and this natural gas that they're trying to frack?
Exactly the same chemical.
No.
Methane and, well, natural gas can have other components, but... Mostly it's methane.
Yes.
Methane is one carbon and four hydrogen, but natural gas contains significant amount. It's mostly methane, like frequently 80% or more, but it also can contain butane, propane, ethane. It can contain significant amounts of nitrogen, carbon dioxide. There, it's sold to you not really by the cubic foot, but by the amount of heating value. So even though you bought a certain number of cubic feet, its heating value is diluted. So they say it's got a correction factor of 0.97 or 0.93, which means there's some number of less combustible or incombustible gases in there. Oh, and carbon monoxide is also a frequent component of methane gas,
of
natural gas.
And you could take natural gas, and if you wanted to further refine it, you could get all that methane out, and then it would be methane, methane, methane. However, as Ken says, they all burn, and so you can sell it unrefined to that extent with those so-called impurities in them. But those impurities are actually burnable in the same way that the octane content of your gasoline, it's not really octane that you're getting, but rather an octane-like ratio or mixture. That's what's in your gasoline.
Okay.
Almost invariably, they remove the heavier hydrocarbons like the ethane, propane, and butane because those are much higher value materials either for chemical synthesis or as portable fuels.
Or to make plastic.
Yeah.
Hey, Pete, we're running out of time here, all right? So I'm going to try and get one more call in. Thanks so much. All right, let's go to Elaine in East Chatham. Elaine, you're on Vox Pop.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to know if you think there's a bigger influx of fishers in the area, because I have a lot of people that have chickens and they're losing them at a regular rate, and they don't leave, whatever kills them doesn't leave anything.
Now, by fishers, you don't mean people who go out with their floppy hats and their fishing poles.
No.
The weasel. The weasel.
I mean that weasel guy that it's very fierce. And I just...
I don't think they'd stop at a chicken, Elaine. Fishers are big.
They make this like really weird cat-like noise, like wow, you know, kind of thing, when they do their kill, and nothing is left. Not like a coyote, you know. That I know, I've heard coyotes kill deer and stuff, and they make like a fierce screaming. Well, she said it's
foxes
like this weird...
make a very eerie scream too. They tend to do it when they're in estrus, when they're in heat, when they're having coitus, they make noise because it's very painful.
But she's losing her chickens.
Well, foxes will take the whole chicken. Will take geese, too. They'll take... won't take a guinea hen because apparently the guinea hens fight back.
Yeah.
To answer your question, at SUNY Cobleskill, where I work, we have a fisheries and wildlife program, and the students very often will do these photo traps where they'll take photos of anything that comes to a bait station.
Right.
We used to never see fishers because they're really an apex predator. They don't.
Right.
They're like the porcupine's only enemy besides
right.
a car. And the fishers are around. I've seen a fisher in my yard, but I can tell you a mink will kill a chicken. And a mink is really much smaller than a chicken, but it's a lot smarter.
Yeah.
It doesn't take much to be smarter than a chicken.
Right.
So the mink will kill a chicken as well. A fisher will, and foxes will regularly kill chickens.
Okay.
And usually the
foxes
will come back.
Well, she's got a pen and everything, but one got in there somehow and killed her rooster, and so she was like all nervous about that, of course. Because she's got like 17 hens.
Well, if she goes to Dick's Sporting Goods or some other sporting goods store, she can buy a photo camera for $80.
Okay.
And it has an infrared light in it, so
right.
it will take pictures after dark, and she can find out who the culprit is.
All right. Okay. And the other thing I want to know is what is the bug? What is the bug that goes wah, 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 wah now in August?
Oh, you people with the bug questions.
We don't know.
We don't have the book in front of us, but
we don't have the bug book in front of us.
Next time we'll
My
have to get the.
My students are going to tell me what they are as soon as I get on Facebook.
They make a noise just like that. Yeah. Wah, 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 wah. And somebody said it was a tree frog, and I said it's not a tree frog.
It's not a tree frog.
I mean, I live in intense woods, and this is not a tree frog. I know what a tree frog sounds like.
Hey, Elaine, we're just about out of time. Yeah, thanks so much for the call. All right. Well, I mean, what is it with the summertime and the bugs? They come out when it's warmer out? Is that the idea?
Well, they have to hatch to the adult form that we hear them in. They're around all the time, but they're pupil, larval, and adult stages.
Okay. Then they come out, and that's when they make the noise.
Yep.
And they're signaling to one another?
Yep. It's time.
It's time for the
time
party.
Time to get on the groove.
All right. Well, we are just about out of time here, but I'd like to thank everyone who called in and apologize to Kevin, Debbie, and Joanna. You can try again next time. Thanks to our panel for being here today, Dr. Barbara Brabitz, Dr. Ken Wells, and Dr. George Shaw. Thank you for joining us today. Underwriting support for Vox Pop comes from Healy Brothers Chevrolet, Poughkeepsie, offering 37 miles per gallon, 2013 Malibu Eco midsize sedan, HealyBrothers.com. The Red Lion Inn, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, offering accommodations for celebrations and business events with access to the Berkshire's outdoor activities, RedLionInn.com. The Digital Berkshire Eagle, an online newspaper for news and information of the Berkshires and beyond, NoInkyFingers.com. New York State tobacco-free community partners working to help parents prevent and reduce youth smoking with prevention programs to counter tobacco marketing and help save lives, New York State tobacco-free community partners at smokefreecapital.org. And Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years, boydenandperrin.com. Thanks again for joining us today. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by the always wonderful Christy Carton. I'm Patrick Donjes. Moyers & Company in this spot tomorrow, Medical Monday next week, where it'll be all Alan and Ray back in the host chair. Stay tuned now for a news update.